Well, you heard Sarah mention it a second ago. Gambo had the news first earlier today here on 98.7 FM Arizona Sports Station and at arizonasports.com. Shane Doan is back, named today as the Coyotes' Chief Hockey Development Officer. And joining us right now, our good friend who's on the Coulter Automotive Group Sports Line, Shane Doan, here on the Burns and Gambo Show. Congratulations, Shane, and not that you ever went anywhere, but welcome back.
Oh, thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it.
Just can't get rid of you, huh?
No, they can't. They tried. They can't.
Did you sell your ranch?
I did.
Why?
Some of the people that were involved, it was getting hard to, like, I had it for 10 years. And I wasn't going to move on to the ranch. And we thought about doing that when I retired, about moving on to there. And we ended up deciding to stay where we're at. And it just didn't, it was taking more away than it was being able to give back. And that was kind of the...
You weren't spending that much time there, huh?
Yeah, I wasn't. As much as I'd like to, I just,
sure.
It wasn't. I thought I was.
Happens all the time with those second homes. You know, you buy them and you want to be there all the time and you're just not there all the time. And then you're like, why am I doing this? I mean, that's what happens.
And to be honest, my parents stayed there a lot and then they ended up not being able to come down. But anyways, sorry.
So you sold it.
So I sold it.
All right. So the biggest question that I had from all the people responding when I broke the news earlier is, what is a chief hockey development officer? What exactly are you going to be doing?
You know what? I have the ability to help out with obviously Mr. Morello and Javier with the business side, and that'll be part of it, and helping out with different things with minor hockey and doing things in the Valley and the relationships I have in the Valley and the fact that I have a relationship with you guys. Like, obviously that's valuable in itself. So I'll help out with that areas, and then also being able to help out with helping out Bill on the hockey side and the hockey ops department, which I've been doing for the last 3 years with the NHL. That's kind of a combination of them both. And that's what the description is.
There you go, Burnsy. He got the job because he has a relationship with us.
Yeah,
all you need to know.
You know what? And I actually assumed that's what you would take out of what I said. So that's what I said. That's why I said it that way.
Oh, that's great.
As always, Shane, you prove you're the smartest guy in the room, Shane. Although in this room, that's not very hard to do. I'm not going to lie to you.
Burnsy was almost on the honor roll, but then he plagiarized some paper and he didn't get on.
These things happen.
Everyone plagiarizes.
How did this thing come about for you? Because I know it was a complex last couple of years, to say the least. And that's the most polite word I could probably use. It's been a complex last couple of years for you. How did this come about for you to be kind of rejoined with the organization for which you're the franchise leader in just about every measurable offensive statistic in their history, Shane?
You know what? It was obviously with the new ownership that came in. I had the opportunity to meet with the Morellos, and then everything kind of happened with COVID and everything that went on, going on through everything. So I had a chance to sit and talk with them for a little bit, but then getting to sit with Javier quite a bit, he got involved and kind of him and I started spending some time together and talking together. And it was encouraging. It was encouraging. And as athletes are viewed, I spoke with Dr. Crow this summer one time, and he pointed out something that was so clear to me, and I agree that for the most part, athletes are takers, from the community where they get given influence, they get given money, they get given power and the ability to kind of do what they want. And for a lot of them, we seem to leave and take and go someplace and not be seen again. And I wanted to be able to kind of give back a little bit and to be part of the Coyotes and help them kind of give back to the community is something that I think I'm the most excited about. And in talking with Javier, that's what his plan is. That's what he wants to do. And that probably got me the most excited of anything.
Shane Doan, our guest here on the Burns and Gambo Show, did there have to be any convincing that needed to be done before you accepted this role for you to make sure that there would be enough significant things for you to do in this role?
Yeah, and I think it's without a doubt, I think there's probably questions on both sides in regards to that. You know, how hard are you actually going to work at this, Shane? And for me, you know, what am I really going to be able to do for you? And I think that that's going to be, as we go forward, that's going to be what we figure out as much as anything. But yeah, there was assurances made on both sides. I'm not here. Like, I started working October 1st after I retired the league. Then the next season started, I wanted to work again. And so that was reassuring for them. And then them saying that, you know what, as we get to know you, you'll definitely get more and more, you know, leashed to be able to help and do things. And at the same time, there's lots that I can do without any of that. I can make a difference in lots of areas without any of that as well. And hopefully that I can come alongside and support, and I can make, you know, each kind of area of the organization a little bit better, and at the same time learn from each area of the organization. As I'm so imbalanced in my overall life because you're so focused on being an athlete that I think you sometimes get a little bit unbalanced, and I'm learning each year I get a little bit more closer to that balance that I want to be.
So in a nutshell, Andrea said, you got to go get a job.
Yeah, she actually was the one that was convincing them that I was going to be able to work, because she's like, hey, please leave for at least a little while every day. Like, leave me alone for a little while.
I've got a chance to meet with Javier when he took over. I was really impressed with his vision, you know, because we've had so much bad ownership. And look, we know this. You would never be in this position under the previous ownership and the previous GM. This would have never happened. So they came in, and I was impressed with what their vision is for the future of this organization, and I was impressed with the Armstrong hire too. I mean, Bill is a really bright guy. He's great at building organizations. Great in the draft. I like the moves he made to try to keep this team competitive. You know, with the salary issues that are at hand right now, to try to give them a chance for that fourth spot in their division, you know, fight with Minnesota for that fourth spot. What were your impressions so far of the hires they've made?
Yeah, I mean, that's the part that, you know, Javier is probably as big a part of anything as of getting me involved. Just I'd met with the Murillos and having talked with them, and then not until Javier, like you said, kind of came on that they really. The dialogue kind of really picked up, and him and I seem to have very similar views in lots of areas of leadership and of community involvement. And I think that was probably as big as anything. And then bringing Bill on is one of those decisions that they made to bring him in, and his talent evaluation and what he's done in the past with St. Louis and all the things that he's done, you get excited. And I think their team's got an opportunity, our team actually again. So our team's got an opportunity to challenge and definitely make it difficult. And it's going to be hard. I mean, it's going to be a hard stretch, and we're going to have to make sure that we count on that 23 kind of man roster. Actually, it's probably going to be more like 27 man rosters with the way that everything's set up with the taxi squads and stuff.
It better be. When, so it's happening in the NBA.
It's crazy. It's crazy what everyone's going through. And you have to understand that you got to be able to roll with it. And you can't overreact to the negative moments that are going to come because of COVID and because of the year that we're in. And I think that'll really tell us a lot about the organization.
Did you want any type of role, you know, on the ice with the players at all? Or do you like this, the role that you have? We're working a little bit more on the business side and minor leagues and things like that.
Yeah, no, I like the role I have. I really do. This is something that I'm excited about. Yeah, I mean, if talk comes to me and is like, hey, I need you to help me out with something because of whatever, because of the situation that this year is, then I'll help out. Like, I'll do whatever they need me to do in that area. You know, it's so funny. Watching the Baltimore game, the Ravens game last night, or whenever they played the other day, or last night, it was interesting when they were talking, when they were 6-5 and they had like a third of their organization had just tested positive for COVID. And they're like, man, did you really see yourselves making it to this far in the playoffs? And it wasn't Harbaugh they were talking to, but I think they were talking to their GM. He said, you know what the key is you just don't get too worked up, and everyone has to help now. Everyone has to come on board, and you're going to get asked to do things that you would never get asked to in a regular season because that just isn't going to be part of it. But right now, with everything going on, we're all going to help in every area possible.
This division is really, really brutal. The top three are just, you know, I mean, it's going to be, I mean, Colorado is, you know, fantastic, and St. Louis is great, and you know, Dallas, it's just, there's some really tough teams there. What do you think about their chances of getting in? I mean, they're kind of rebuilding a little bit on the fly, but also trying to remain competitive at the same time.
Yeah, you look at what happened prior to Taylor Hall getting here last year, and that was, their team was in first place and everyone was raving about them. Now, obviously, with Kemp and Rantz getting hurt, and it kind of changed, you know, a lot of the game plan of what was going on. But that group is a similar group to what we have. You lost Richie, who is such a huge part of the dressing room, and Step, which is a big part of the dressing room, and so does Sorstrom. And those guys are going to be important pieces that we lost. But I think that the fact that the guys that are in their fourth year take another step. You hope those guys take another step. And if that's the case, you added Brassard, and you hopefully those guys do that, take that step, and they can stay healthy, and we'll see how it goes, because those guys are important.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the divisions. It's Colorado, St. Louis, and Vegas.
Vegas is beast.
Three great teams, and then I imagine – you know, Minnesota and the Yotes battle for that fourth spot for the playoffs. Now, you never know what's going to happen with, you know, Anaheim or San Jose.
But I think San Jose is going to be good.
You think San Jose is going to be good?
I do. I think that they got, I mean, you look at where they've been prior to last year. They've had success. I'm not saying they're going back to what they were, but I'm a big Timo Meier fan. I think that they got some players, young guys that are good. Obviously, Logan Couture, their captain, and then their back end is really solid. If Dubnyk and Jones are good, they're going to really fight us for that spot, and you have to give them some credit, but I don't think it's not doable. I think that Minnesota's got a good team, and Billy Guerin's doing a good job with getting them kind of turned around and going in the right direction after a tough start to last year. If you take out their first nine games of the year, they had a really good stretch going forward after that. So it's going to be difficult. I do think that if you look at where we were at the December 1st, we were pretty excited about our group, and we're kind of back to that group, and we're hoping they can carry us.
Good stuff, Doner. As always, so good to hear your voice. Congratulations again on the new job. Really is. No, it's just good. It's just good to talk with you again, man, and we look forward to many, many conversations over the course of the next few months with you. Congrats again. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Burns. We really appreciate it, Gamble. Thanks, guys. And yes, I get to hear you guys' voice all the time, so yeah, once in a while when you have to hear mine, I appreciate it.
We don't mind, my friend. Congratulations. We're happy to see you back with the organization. That's where you belong.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Shane Doan joining us, Coulter Automotive Group Sports Line. Coulter Cadillac Tempe. Experience the difference. Visit CoulterCadillacTempe.com. Thanks in part to the Ravens and the Bills, the young quarterbacks, ruling the AFC so far in the playoffs. We'll talk about it next on the Burns and Gambo Show. Just look at the quarterbacks, if you will, that are left in the AFC. Lamar Jackson, Josh Allen, Baker Mayfield, Patrick Mahomes. You don't need to be an ardent fan of the NFL to know what they all have in common. They're all young. They're all young. They all have many, many, many years of greatness left in them. Gambo, you referenced a changing of the guard, if you will, with what happened last night, Baker beating Ben and some of these older quarterbacks who might be a step away from retirement. It happened
Rivers.
A couple of times. Yep, and that's the other one. It happened a couple of times this weekend where the young gun quarterback beat the established old guy veteran, and none more so noteworthy than Lamar Jackson. I don't want to call it a monkey on his back, man. It was two playoff games. It wasn't a big sample size.
It wasn't.
But he got that first one, and that probably feels really good for him.
Well, and he had, you know, one of my favorite plays. Again, it was so many great plays over the weekend. That touchdown run by Lamar Jackson was unreal. I mean, that 48-yard touchdown scramble was sensational. He had a good game. You know, I don't dislike Lamar. I don't know why some people, you know, don't root for him. I mean, he is what he is, right? I mean, you can't compare him to anybody else. There's nobody to compare him to. He just turned 24 years old, and he's the third youngest quarterback to win an NFL MVP and a playoff game. Only Dan Marino and Mahomes had done that. So I've never understood the whole, oh, he's got to get the monkey off his back. He's lost these two playoff games. Man, they're going to come. I mean, he had some bad games that was in the previous playoffs. But this was a good game. This was a good win. The Ravens had, I mean, they had to shut down Derrick Henry, man. They stacked that box. Here you go. Eight defenders in the box. Good luck trying to run. And he couldn't run. I mean, Derrick Henry couldn't run. But they said, you know, beat us. Have Tannehill beat us. Because their whole goal was, they lined eight guys up in the box almost the entire game, Bernsie.
Yep.
Three guys out in coverage. They said, we're just not going to let Derrick Henry beat us. And they didn't.
And he didn't. He had just 40 yards rushing, where the Ravens as a team had 236 yards rushing total. And that's just not Lamar Jackson and that 48-yard touchdown run that you're talking about. That's J.K. Dobbins. That's Gus Edwards. I mean, they literally pounded the Titans into submission with that run game. And then that started opening things up for Marquise Brown. He ended up having over 100 yards receiving. It was just a really well-played game by the Ravens. Offensively, defensively, here's John Harbaugh after the game. He called it the best win he thinks he's ever had in the playoffs.
I'm going to tell you right now, it's the number one best win. All right? Now, in perspective, it's going to be a top five for sure. But right now, for me, this is the best win ever. And not just because of what was at stake, but because of the guys and what it meant to our team and to our guys, you know, what it meant to all of our guys. This may be the best one I've ever been associated with. Defensive effort, like you said, it was discipline. It was eyes on your luggage. It was finishing. It was running to the ball. It was tackling. Up front, our defensive line did a phenomenal job against their very good offensive line. So we got them stopped a lot of times before we got started. All those things came into play.
Ever?
Wow.
Yeah,
I mean, ever? They won a Super Bowl.
They won a Super Bowl. Yes, he's got a Super Bowl ring, and he's calling this one the best one he's ever had. Well, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I don't know about that, as our old friend Mike Salk would say. I don't know about that.
Yeah, I think that they went out there and they did what they needed to do to stop that run. And we talked about Calais Campbell and the moves that they made. But that defense stepped up big time. I mean, they really did. Marcus Peters with that interception and then going to stomp on the logo celebration afterwards.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, they went out and they made the moves defensively that they needed to make to be able to, just for this game, to be able to shut down Derrick Henry. And they did. They shut down, you know, one of the best running backs in the game, if not the best. And they got a good game out of Lamar Jackson. He played well. And they end up coming away with the victory. I thought the Ravens would win this game, but it was a hard fought game. And I just as much as we want to credit Lamar, we got to credit that defense for how well that they played.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that one. But Lamar, and it's not even so much the 0-2 in the playoffs that surprised me. I didn't know this. It was his first win in this league when trailing by double digits. He was 0-6. Before that game on Saturday or on Sunday morning. I didn't know that, but they were down 10 in the first half, and that qualifies as his first ever win. Speaking of firsts, Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills, their first playoff victory since 1995. Okay, the Browns beat them by a year, but not by much. Two rabid fan bases got kind of their due over the weekend, and Josh Allen was very, very good in that game against the Colts. And there was that big swing at the end of the first half when Frank Reich decided to go for it on fourth and goal. And then the Bills, when they stymied them, turned around, drove 91 yards for the go-ahead touchdown. Then they added the field goal at the beginning of the second half. And the ball game kind of swung right there in that moment between those two teams.
Yeah, I didn't understand. I mean, Reich made two, you know, critical decisions. You know, in that game, I think that, you know, that really, really hurt them. And he went with the numbers, right? He went with the analytics on what to do. But you look at the Rivers to Pascal touchdown brought the Colts within 24-16. So they're down. You kick an extra point and you're down by seven. They decide to go for two after a penalty gave them the ball at the one. I didn't understand that, right? Kick the extra point and you're down by seven instead of being down by eight. Then, you know, Bass hits the huge 54-yard field goal. Now the Bills are up by 11. Now they do come back. They get the touchdown to Doyle, wide open. And then they go for two and they get it to make it a three-point game again. And then you had that controversial play with Pascal. Was it which they totally botched that whole thing. But
totally,
yeah, I didn't understand why they didn't take the points in the first half and just go get three on the board. I mean, I think his mistakes really, really hurt them, and maybe a lot is being put into that. But Allen played well, and, you know, the Buffalo Bills, you know, in front of a home crowd for the first time this season, they get their first playoff win since 1995 when they beat Dan Marino and the Dolphins. Wow.
When we come back, so far through the first 10 games of the season, one thing is very clear, and that is that the Phoenix Suns are getting contributions from a lot of different people. They don't go as just two guys go. We'll talk about it next on the Burns and Gambo Show. Monday edition, Burns and Gambo Show. John Gambadoro, Dave Burns, thank you for hanging out with us. I know Gambo despises power rankings, and to be honest with you, I'm not that far behind him.
Number two.
When it comes to something like that. Number two, was it NBA.com, right?
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, number two on NBA.com. I know you do.
I
really don't use them. I use them to start conversations. That's it. That's the only reason why I look at them, is to start conversations, not because I think the Suns are the second-best team in the NBA right now or the fifth-best team in the NBA, but to start conversations. And in particular, the conversation I want to start about the Phoenix Suns right now, if it's all right with you, is about Mikal Bridges and, to a lesser extent, Cam Johnson. In ESPN's power rankings today, they have the Suns as number five, and in their write-up, they say Mikal Bridges is making an early case for most improved player, and he's coming off a career-high 34-point effort against the Pacers on Saturday night. But our friends over at Bright Side of the Sun, Gambo, took it one step further, and they basically presented some numbers that suggest Chris Paul's not the key, Devin Booker's not the key, DeAndre Ayton's not the key. If you want to know whether the Suns are going to win or lose, look at Mikal Bridges and, to a lesser extent, Cam Johnson. Those guys will tell you if the Suns are going to win or lose on any given night. Very interesting stuff.
Yeah, you know, I said this last week. I think when Chris Paul's not here and you're looking at who's the big three for the Suns, I think he becomes that guy. And he might become that guy, you know, this year. It might not even take 2 years. Mikal Bridges is turning into one of the, you know, a guy who could be a star player in this league. I mean, let's not sugarcoat this. He's turning into one of the best wing players in the league. Somebody said he might be most improved player. I mean, did you send that to me? He could be the most improved player in the league?
Yeah, I just mentioned that a second ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you throw that in there, and then you look at the fact that you've got Booker and you've got Ayton and Mikal. I mean, Mikal was in the same draft class as Ayton. All of these guys are young. He's a big piece to what they're gonna do going forward. Which is why, and even Cam too, which is why when they were going after Chris Paul, there was never any discussions about including either one of these guys in any deal when they were, you know, these guys were untouchable.
No, and nor should there have been. And any suggestion to the contrary was foolish to even think about, the idea that you would include Cam Johnson or Mikal Bridges. Here's the number that Brightside put out there. In the three games where he scored between 0 and 9 points, Suns are 0-3. In the five games in which he scored 10 to 19 points, the Suns are 5-0. The two games in which he scored 20 or more points, the Suns are 2-0. So basically, if Mikal Bridges scores at least 10 points, Phoenix Suns are 7-0 so far in the season. Now, eventually, will he have a game where he scores 17 and they lose? Yes, of course, that will happen. This will not hold over the course of a season, but it is interesting to think, and the whole point of the article was that, look, Booker is Booker. You pretty much know what you're going to get at this point. Paul is Paul. You pretty much know what you're going to get. Same for Ayton for the most part. You know at the minimum with Ayton, you're probably going to get 10 or more points and 10 or more rebounds. But if they're really, you know, everybody's three best players are pretty consistent at this point in their career, your ability to separate from yourselves, and you've talked about this so many times, I've lost track, is not your top two or three guys, but the guys you have after those guys. And that's where Mikal and Cam have really stood out this year.
Yeah, because the depth is going to be so key for them, you know, to win. They're going to really rely on that depth. You know, Mikal played his freshman and sophomore to his junior year over at Villanova. I mean, you look at the accolades, right? You know, two-time NCAA champion. I mean, he won an NCAA championship, you know, 3 years ago. Two-time NCAA champion, third-team All-American, First team All Big East, second team All Big East, Big East co-defensive player of the year, Big East tournament MVP. I mean, NCAA All Final Four team, NCAA All Tournament team. I mean, the 3 years he got in college is so valuable. It's a shame that a lot of these GMs look at these guys that have played 3 years and see that there's something wrong with them. Oh, my goodness. He should have, if he didn't come out after his freshman year, he must not be that good. You know, James Jones likes the experience factor. He got that. You know, now, he didn't draft McHale. That was still Ryan McDonough. But they got McHale with that experience and then Cam with that experience. And, you know, that experience, you know, James is really big on having that college experience because these guys come into the league and are a lot more mature and you kind of know who they are a little bit more.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who think that James was very influential, though, in the organization drafting McHale Bridges. I remember that very distinctly from that night. Chris Paul, on Saturday, after the win against the Pacers in which Bridges had the 34 points, called McHale Bridges one of the best guys I've been around, and I've been in this league a long time.
Been around a lot of guys in this league over the years, and he's one of the best guys I think I've ever been around. So to see him do well and to see his game blossoming the way it is, it's nice because he deserves it.
That's Chris Paul talking about McHale Bridges, one of the best guys I've ever been around, right?
That's high praise right there. That's high praise. You know, I mean, what he said, I mean, he's been around a lot of great players, a lot of great players. And those comments, I mean, again, high praise for McHale Bridges. McHale wants to win. He'll do whatever is necessary. He's so good defensively, and his offensive game is just as good. There just doesn't seem to really be a weakness in his game. He could pass. He could defend. He could shoot the three. He could drive and score. You know, there's not really, you know, I just don't see any real weakness in his game. He does some things exceptionally well, and everything else he does pretty good.
Yeah. Chris Paul went on to say, not only is he one of the best guys I've been around, he's a fun guy to be around.
Aside from Kale, like, taking, you know, pretty much the toughest defensive lineman night in and night out, he can hoop. He nice, but then he's slick, man. You got to watch him. You got to watch him. He real slick with his tongue, real. But a fun guy, like a very fun guy to be around. And he just got a great spirit around him. I mean, about him. A great spirit about him. He works. He puts the work in. So, you know, he's one of those guys that when I kick it to him and, you know, he hits his shot, like I feel like I made it.
That's cool, oh, man. That's almost cooler than the thing he said before. Yeah. He's the kind of guy that when I kick it to him and he makes it, I feel like I made it. You know?
Wow. You know, the only weakness in his game is not really knowing that the ice buckets were coming for him. I mean, they were all laid out there right on the floor. He comes walking in. He's, you know, he's not even thinking about it. He's slapping every, you know, he does not. Do you not see the four yellow buckets filled with ice sitting right there on the floor? He didn't even think of it. He never saw it coming. Never saw it coming.
Yeah. After his 34-point night against Indiana on Saturday, he got doused and dumped in that locker room by his teammates. And we referenced this earlier. I think that kind of is a physical manifestation of what we're talking about with Chris Paul, man. We just like him. He's a likable guy. He's one of the best guys we've been around. And you can see how happy his teammates were for him with that celebration after they beat the Pacers and he dropped 34 on them. You can see that genuine kind of like in how they respond to him. But he's not the only one. And Brightside went a little deeper, and they even looked at Cam Johnson, and the numbers are kind of similar. In the three games in which he scored 0 to 9 points, the Suns are 1-2. When he scores 10 or more, they are 6-1 so far this season. So what we're starting to see, as those two guys go, so go the Phoenix Suns, at least early so far in this season. And we'll see how those guys go tonight when they're taking on the Wizards. No Westbrook for the Wizards. No Thomas Bryant for the Wizards. Sounds like Bradley Beal's going to play, but this is a Wizards team off to a 2-8 start. They are beat to hell right now, and it looks like an opportunity for the Suns to get that, close out this road trip with a win and improve to 2-1 on the road trip.
No, they really like that Thomas Bryant. He tore the ACL left knee for the game Saturday, and he's going to miss the rest of the season is what they're saying. So he has been really, they've really liked him. He's in his fourth year in the NBA. I mean, he's been shooting the ball well and rebounding the ball and everything. So now they'll go to former Sun Robin Lopez, who's been in the league for 13 years, believe it or not. It seems like yesterday when he slammed that glass door and broke it at the Suns practice facility. But Robin Lopez will play. You know, no Russell Westbrook. He's a nightmare matchup. He's just so physically gifted and strong. He doesn't shoot the ball well anymore. He's getting older. So now, but now you really concentrate on Bradley Beal. And I'm sure Mikal's going to get a lot of assignment there on Bradley Beal. He is such a great, great player. Just such a great player. And he could I mean, he could put 50 on you like that. I mean, he's just that good. But they don't play any defense, Washington. So that's where that probably comes in. Like, they don't play any defense. They're 2-8. They've got one guy that can absolutely carry them. But without Westbrook and then without Thomas Bryant, I think they're really going to be shorthand. Now, listen, you know, we thought that the Suns would beat Detroit, and they didn't. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. But, you know, I feel better that they're playing, you know, playing this game without, you know, two of Washington's key players not playing in this game.
Tom Brady and the Buccaneers moving on in the NFC playoffs. They were almost undone by a quarterback who was making just his second career start and turned a lot of heads on Saturday night. We'll talk about it coming up on the Burns and Gambo Show. Oh, we just got done talking about the young quarterbacks in the AFC. I mean, if you look at it, it's Lamar Jackson, Josh Allen, Baker Mayfield, and Patrick Mahomes. Man, in the NFC, it's a completely different story to the point where Gambo, Andrew Siciliano of the NFL Network, average age of the four remaining AFC quarterbacks is roughly 25 years of age. Average age of the four remaining NFC quarterbacks is about 37 years of age. There's a 12-year difference between the average age of the AFC quarterback and the NFC quarterback, and none highlights that better than the two quarterbacks we're about to talk about in this segment. Tom Brady and the Bucs, Drew Brees and the New Orleans Saints.
Yeah, only in sports can 37 be considered old.
Right? Yeah.
My God, he's just so old. How is he still playing at 37? 40, my goodness. You know, guys in their 4, my God, he's in his 40s. Wow.
Yeah.
But that's what you get.
For an old guy, he looked pretty good on Saturday night. He being Tom Brady, played very, very well against the Washington defense that I didn't think played up nearly up to their level. And Tom Brady just had his way with them that night.
He did. You know, that game, for the most part, they were in control of it throughout. You know, that kid put up one hell of an effort, you know, Henneke, which we'll talk about in a second. But I thought that, you know, I thought that Tom Brady did a great job, especially with the deep ball. They really connected on some of those deep passes, and that was a problem for them earlier in the season, and there was a lot of talk about Bruce's offense and how Bruce's offense just doesn't work for Tom Brady. He's not a guy that, you know, likes to throw the ball down the field like that. He's more of a dink and dunker, and this isn't going to work. And now you just look at him, and he's kind of, you know, it always takes a little bit of a while. Same thing with Carson Palmer. It takes a little while to kind of figure out the Bruce Arians offense. But then once you do and it starts clicking, well, you know, then it's really good. So what do you throw? 381 yards, 2 touchdowns. They got a great performance by Leonard Fournette. He was great. Evans was great. The game, you know, when David finally got the sack on Henneke, you know, that's when, you know, the game was won for Tampa Bay. But I thought the Tampa Bay was in control throughout that game. Washington, would you, man, I'll give them credit. They wouldn't go away. They played their hardest. They were clearly overmatched, but they hung around as long as they could.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know what I was really impressed by, and at this point it's hard to be impressed by anything Tom Brady has done because he's done so much. But you mentioned Washington, and man, every single time they came back to make a game of it, Tom Brady would do something to just push that lead out a little further. You know, it's a 9-0 game. Washington scores on the McKissick 2-yard touchdown. It's 9-7. Brady comes back, finds Godwin, 27-yard touchdown. It's 15-7. Pushes it out. Then the Heineke touchdown run, which was, I swear to God, my second favorite play of
what
the weekend.
Great play.
That was unbelievable when he dove for the pylon like that. That makes it 18-16. And immediately after that, Tom Brady leads a field goal drive with Ryan Succop and then the Fournette touchdown run. Every single time Washington got close, Tom Brady did just enough to make sure he kept Washington at a comfortable distance away. I'm with you. I give Washington a lot of credit. I think if they had played better defensively, which I thought they were going to, they would have had a real chance to win that football game because Heineke was terrific on Saturday night.
Yeah. Well, they had that one rookie running back, Keyshawn Vaughn. He had that huge fumble, right, at the end of the third quarter. He had that fumble, and that's when that set up that great Henneke touchdown run that we were just talking about. But that was like a big fumble, and that's when, you know, you thought that Tampa Bay was going to put him away three or four different times, and then, you know, they just kept hanging around because that made it a two-point game. At the end of the third quarter, it's a two-point game, and you're like, damn, it's like they're not – you know, they're just not going in. You realize they didn't have the firepower to win the game, right? They didn't have the firepower to win it. But man, the fact that they hung around, and what everybody's saying about that game is you're not going to be New Orleans playing like that if you're Tampa. Like, they have to have another gear to get to. Evans was good, Fournette was good, Brady was good, but they were a little sloppy at times, and they're going to have to play better if they're going to get the next win.
Yeah, and Heinicke, here's Ron Rivera, his coach, and how proud he is of him.
It was gutsy. It really was. And it's one of those things that, you know, a guy like him who works hard at what he does, you know, he's created an opportunity for himself, and we'll see what happens. But I'm just very, very proud of what he did, coming out and competing the way he did and helping us to get where we are today.
But if this weekend was all about streaks ending, then the Bucks ended their streak. That was their first playoff appearance since 2007. It was also their first playoff win since they won the Super Bowl in the 2002 season. It's been that long,
man,
since the Bucks
Bills,
won
the Browns,
right,
the Bucks,
right? I know,
shattering these, you know, long droughts.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing I can say is we'll never see Detroit shatter anything. We don't have to worry about the Lions ever doing anything. That's one team, rest assured, for as long as you live, they'll never be any good. The Detroit Lions.
You mentioned hiking. I was out hiking after the Cardinals season ended last weekend, and I was wearing a Cardinals T-shirt. And somebody I passed on the trail said, man, you got a lot of guts wearing that thing. And I said, well, you know, I stand by him no matter what. And he said, that's okay, I'm a Lions fan. I said,
oh
God,
my God,
you've got it worse than anybody I know, and I don't know you, man. I just met you. I can't imagine there's anybody in this world who has it worse from a sports standpoint. You're a Lions fan? You poor guy. I feel terrible for you. Awful.
Yeah.
They suck.
Yeah. Yeah, you were probably like, look, you could go ahead of me. You're good. Go ahead of me.
Okay, you know what? You've had it rough in life. Please, after you. No such rough luck for the New Orleans Saints in what we thought was going to be the most uninspiring game of the weekend. The Saints and the Bears was the most uninspiring game of the weekend until the Bears got that unbelievable one-handed touchdown grab at the end. Their offense had been completely shut down by the Saints defense. To the point where Trubisky, probably his last game as a Bear. Matt Nagy, people are talking about him like he might be on the hot seat, given that he's been the main offensive guy there for the last few years. That was a very disheartening game if you're a Bears fan watching the Saints dominate them the way they did.
God, they just, you know, they just had no – they didn't even have a puncher's chance in that game, right? I mean, they didn't even have a puncher's chance. That was the one – like, that was the one game – I think we both kind of said it. Like, if there was one guaranteed lock, the Saints were going to roll. They got Kamara back, Michael Thomas, and they just weren't. Now, I thought that they could have done better offensively and scored some more points, but, you know, they rolled to that victory. Kamara was pretty good, right? He had almost 100 yards, and, you know, Breeze was good in that game. It sets up the Breeze-Brady match, which Breeze said was inevitable. But the Bears, man, there's a lot of talk now about the Mitch Trubisky era in Chicago. Is it over? I mean, that Jimmy Graham one-handed catch at the end of that game was pretty cool, too. I mean, that was a really great catch.
But that was it. That was the only
that
offensive
was it.
Highlight.
Six
they
first
had.
Downs.
Yep.
Zero third down conversions before their final drive. You know, people were saying, did they go to Foles? Should they go to Foles? And it's just, yeah, it's just, you know, it'd be interesting to see what happens with Trubisky. I don't know that anybody gives him a chance to start, but, okay, like, say the Cardinals got him as a backup. I'd feel a lot more comfortable with him as the backup quarterback.
Well, than Chris Streveler? Yeah, at this point, I would, too. Yeah, I mean,
like,
at least
I was thinking about that during the game. If this is it for Trubisky, and he's going to go make, you know, he could be a higher-paid backup, $2.5, $3 million type of guy, because he's got all that experience. Like, hey, if the Cardinals signed Mitch Trubisky to be the backup quarterback, okay. You know, listen, I don't think he's great, but for a backup quarterback, you know, I think that that would be fine. You know, he'd be, he could be decent as a back. But if you're Chicago, you know, you've had him for 4 years now. I mean, like, you should know what you have, right? You should know what you have. You've had four years of him. Do you like him enough to keep him, or do you not? I heard Tony Romo on the broadcast say, I'll tell you, and he went to a commercial break, but I'll tell you what's going to happen with Mitch Trubisky. And I'm like, oh, what, does Tony Romo know something? And then he went to a commercial break. They come back, and he says, listen, it's pretty simple. If you can get a better quarterback, then you move on. If you can't, you keep him. I'm like, all right, Tony, here you go. Yes, if you can find a better quarterback, you need to sit through a commercial break for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought there'd be some insight there, but there really wasn't. Yeah. It was just, if you can find a better quarterback, then you move on. And if you can't find a better quarterback, then you keep the guy.
They were facing a team that didn't have a healthy quarterback. So is Seattle's loss to the Rams a sign of bigger issues for the Seahawks? That's coming up on the Burns and Gambo Show.